Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are India Cardamone and Cole Peterson, both rising seniors from Aspen High School. They will be interviewing Sonia Paban, an associate professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin. Sonia completed her PhD at the University of Barcelona, Spain, and then moved to the U.S. as a Fulbright Fellow. Her research is focused in the fundamental physics of the early universe, more concretely, a period known as cosmic inflation, or just inflation. This period is thought to have started when the universe was less than a blink of an eye old and lasted for a period of time so small it's hard to think about. But the basic inflationary paradigm is accepted by most physicists, as a number of inflation model predictions have been confirmed by observation. But the detailed particle physics mechanisms responsible for inflation is unknown. Sonia's research seeks to understand how likely it was for the universe to enter this period of exponential expansion, and she's also interested in which detailed particle physics mechanisms are both compatible with the observations and with string theory.
Okay, how and when did you first gain interest in physics and cosmology specifically?
Cosmology more recently than physics. I became interested in physics in high school. I suppose like many students, I was interested in math, chemistry, and physics. Of those three disciplines, I thought math was too abstract. I liked to make contact with the real world. And I thought physics was more fundamental. Once I started my physics career in my graduate school, I went into high energy physics, which is basically the story of the physics that governs very, very small distances. And I did that for a while. But then more and more data became available in cosmology, and so I became more interested in cosmology. So probably the last 10, 12 years.
You've done a lot of research in a lot of different fields, from quantum field theory to cosmology to string theory. I was just wondering which of the areas that you've researched do you find to be the most intriguing or to have the most promise for future science?
Well, the most intriguing undoubtedly is string theory. string theory right now is the only candidate that we have of a consistent theory of quantum gravity. I think we are very far from understanding the consequences of string theory. Cosmology is basically the energies that I'm interested in, what happened very, very early in the universe, will eventually touch, or already touches, the region that the string theory should cover. And that's partly what I'm looking at. Though, to be honest, where we can see now, or what we are observing, should be compatible with the string theory, but it's not going to test the string theory.
Can you talk a little about what cosmic inflation is and what you do as a cosmologist?
Okay. So, because the speed of light is finite, every time we look in the universe, what we see is not how it's now, but how it was in the far back, right? And now you can say, well, how early can we see what happened in the universe? And so the earliest light that we can see is what's known as the cosmic microwave background. And that is light that was emitted more or less when the universe was 380,000 years old. So that's as far as we can see. That's the data that we have. And that's data that's gathered by satellites and also by some experiments, for example, at the South Pole. Now, so what we do is we look at that data, and so this was discovered, the cosmic microwave background was accidentally discovered, I think around 1967, around that. I may be wrong. And it was accidentally discovered by people at Bell Labs, and it was soon realized what it was by people in Princeton. And after that, in the 90s, there was a satellite called COBE that checked this light. And so basically when you measure the frequencies of this light, so what frequencies are peak, and you measure the profile, that gives you a sense of the temperature that the universe had at the time. And the original satellite could not, the precision wasn't good enough to see fluctuations in this temperature. But then it was soon realized that there are fluctuations in these temperatures. These fluctuations are very small. So if the temperature is around 2.73 whatever Kelvin, the fluctuation is 1 part in 5. Now, and so this means you look at different areas. So you, in the sphere of the universe, you look around, and different points fluctuate by that amount. Now you can say, well, in physics, when there are the fluctuations are so tiny, there has to be a reason for that. Okay, how could it be that these different points are all at the same temperature at that time? Okay, and then people said, well, we know that the universe is expanding, right? That's one of the big breakthroughs of the last century. So it could be that all these points were together at some time, and that's what they all look like, they have the same temperature. Now, from what we know about the history of the universe, you can say, okay, suppose, so we know from the equations of general relativity that how fast the universe expands, depends on the type of energy that dominates, the energy density at the time. At the time, before the thought of cosmic inflation came about, it was thought that, okay, you could have radiation dominated, which means basically the energy is dominated by relativistic particles, or it's dominated by particles that are not relativistic, which we call matter domination. Okay, it became clear that even if you take the universe and you run the clock backwards, like if you take a movie and you run the movie backwards, you can do the same thing about the universe. That's what we do all the time. that these points couldn't be connected. Okay, so this means that neither form, it couldn't be that the universe was dominated by radiation or was dominated by matter. So then Alan Guth, and this was 1991, and at the same time there was a similar discovery in the Soviet Union, but they were not connected at the time because there wasn't much interaction, by Starobinsky and Andrei Linden. Well, they said if the universe at some point had an energy density which is almost constant, which doesn't change with time, even if the universe expands, the energy density remains constant, then the universe will have expanded very, very, very fast. And this can explain all these points that appear disconnected will have been together in the far back. Now, this very short period is what we call cosmic inflation. So the reason of inflation, you can see why, because the universe expanded very, very fast. So if you think about the economy, right, inflation means how fast the prices grow up. So this is how fast the universe expanded. And this is what they gave the word inflation. So that's what cosmic inflation is.
So what are the implications of this cosmic inflation to modern day physics and what you're researching? So what, how can you kind of move forwards from that inflationary principle?
So it turns out that inflation originally, as I said, was introduced to explain why the temperature at these different points was the same and why the fluctuations were so small. And there were other reasons at the time, like at the time theories of grand unification were very fashionable, and there were something called monopoles, so magnetic monopoles. So usually when you take a magnet and you try to... So we have isolated electric charges, but we don't have isolated magnetic charges. If you take a magnet and you split it, you still have South and North Pole. But if these theories of grand unification, which were very popular at the time, are true, then you should have magnetic monopoles. And we don't see them around, so you have to dilute the density, and this theory of inflation, because the universe expands very fast, will have basically pushed them away, and the density will be so low that will be compatible with what we see. Now, it turns out that when people started thinking about fundamental models of a field theory that could explain this inflation period, they realized that one can explain these small temperature fluctuations. The origin could be quantum fluctuations, and that's very interesting. So you have a field that moves very little during this inflation period. We call this field inflaton. That could be an example. The energy density is almost constant during that period. But the field is a quantum field, and then it will fluctuate. The value will change. And it's precisely these small fluctuations that we think are the seed of these tiny temperature fluctuations. The consequence of this is enormous, because as a result of these tiny temperature fluctuations, the regions expand differently. Gravity affects their expansion differently. And these, once you incorporate the existence of dark matter, will give you a structure for the universe. So this will give the seeds of galaxies that are the how everything, you know, basically gives the structure of the universe that we see now at the large scale structure. Hmm.
Okay. So what was the universe like before the inflation?
Very good question. So we don't know is the short answer. Okay. And that's part of what I said I'm trying, what many people are trying to understand. So this period of inflation explains what we see. I said, it was said at the introduction that most people accept this, not everyone accepts this. So one of the issues is, I think questions we want to understand is, okay, we have all these models that we have that explain cosmic inflation assume that we have a field that is basically the same value everywhere in space at a given time, and it changes as the time moves forward. Now, this is a very unique configuration. And you can say, well, why, you know, who ordered that, so to speak, right? And but then, for example, a work I did a couple of years ago, and there were two groups of people who did this research in this space. Other people had done it earlier. Just now we have more powerful computers and we could do the simulations. Is, well, suppose that you don't start with a field that's the same every point in space. This field could vary from point to point. But still the energy, and so at the beginning the energy density is not constant. It's dominated by what we call the gradient, which is basically how the field changes from point to point. But still there is the potential for this field. Okay, let's see how I explain this. There is a part of the energy density that is constant, even though it's subdominant. So you put this in a computer, you give the laws of general relativity, which is basically what tells you what the shape of a space is once you know the energy density, and then you let this evolve. And what we saw is that if there is something called a cosmological constant, then all these gradients disappear. Basically, the field becomes more and more uniform everywhere in space. So there are areas where you can form black holes, which clearly the field is not uniform, but these areas are pushed, these black holes are pushed away, and you have areas in the middle where the field is very uniform, and then you can start inflation. So this doesn't completely answer your question because we didn't take the most general conditions. We assume we were in a regime where general relativity is true, but at least it partially answers the question.
Yeah.
But that's an open question. We don't know the answer to that.
What is it like working theoretically instead of with something that you can like actually grasp physically and see happening? What's it like to work with theory?
Well, I think people do different things, right? I mean, there are people who really like to solve problems with pen and paper or computers, and then there are people who like to touch things with their hands. I think, what is it like? Well, I think it's I don't know you, and I don't know if you, for example, do you prefer to, do you like, for example, when you are more in the laboratory, or do you like it more when you are solving a math problem? At the high school level, it's very hard to distinguish, right? Because, but I think more theoreticians are people who like to understand what's the origin. How do you answer the most pressing problems? And I think both types are needed. Theoreticians cannot do without experimentalists. They will just run. You know, you can make many theories that are consistent, but not all these theories are going to explain the world, right? And so mathematicians make beautiful constructions. If those constructions are related to the world or not, we don't know, right? And it doesn't matter. I mean, sometimes these beautiful constructions appear when you try to actually solve something in the real world. But the reason why these people made the beautiful construction had nothing to do with the real world. And I think, you know, right now, understanding quantum gravity is the biggest question, right? We all try to answer, and there have been many spin-offs, if you want, of possible explanations that may or may not have anything to do with the real world, but because the problems are so interesting, people pursue them. I mean, at a personal level, I, for example, love to cook, and I think part of that is that sometimes I get home and I need to touch something real. So I get home at 7 or whatever, I get home and I love to spend half an hour, 1 hour just cooking and cutting and doing things that don't involve my brain necessarily, that involve other parts of my person. So I don't know if that answers your question.
What led you to decide to teach physics?
You mean to become a professor?
Yeah.
As opposed to go to industry or whatever? Mm-hmm. I think because I'm more motivated to understand, you know, what's at the base of everything. And that was it. And I was lucky enough to get a faculty position. That's the answer. There are many people who are motivated, and, you know, there is a factor of luck. I mean, you have to be good, but at a certain point there are so many positions, and, you know, mm-hmm. that matters.
What would you say are some of the most defining moments in your career where you were just like, wow, I really am doing this for the right reason. I really love what I'm doing. And this makes it makes sense to me, you know?
Okay. I think the career of a physicist is full of frustrations. you know, many times you start something And you really don't know if it's going to give you what you want at the end of the day. So what are those defining moments? Well, years back, for example, there was a satellite at the time. It was called WMAP and was measuring the cosmic microwave background. And particularly, it was storing. So I said there are these fluctuations. So you can study the correlation between these fluctuations. And so you can study, for example, you can take, you can say, okay, I'm going to average. So I'm going to take an angle between two points in the sphere. So you take a sphere and you look at the temperature fluctuations at two points that make an angle, let's say, of 10 degrees. And then you find all possible sets of points, and then you average what the temperature fluctuations are. And then you can do the same thing with three points, and so on. So if the particular three-point function, you know, you could study that average and you can compute. Anyway, you can do a measurement of that quantity. And if the fundamental explanation for cosmic inflation was one field or several fields, you will get different results. And at the time, there was a lot of excitement because they seemed that they were measuring that this correlation was non-zero. But there was a huge uncertainty. And then there was, and that experiment couldn't do better to reduce the uncertainty. And then they launched another satellite called Planck. And this satellite could measure with more precision. Okay. And so they were about to release the data, and we did some computations, and we realized, well, they are not going to measure something which is not zero, even though the other one seemed to measure something which was different than zero. And at the end of the day, they didn't measure anything. So that was exciting. because of something, a computation that we had done that said, well, they are not going to measure something which is non-zero in a particular model. I don't know. I think every time I understand something that puzzles me, it's a very rewarding moment. That's why we do this. So.
Can you describe some of your early research and how that led to what you're doing today?
I'm unusual in that I have worked in several fields of high energy physics and fundamental physics. And I think because I started my PhD in a very esoteric subject, partly because that's what the problem my advisor gave me at the time. Very often when you start a PhD, it depends where you are at and you know what kind of problems your advisor is doing at the moment. Then I moved to the US, as I said, and at the time there was a lot of excitement on a subject that's called CP violation. When you have an elementary particle, so the particle, I mean, I don't know what your vision is, but you can think of your particle basically as an electron, for example, right? And you can think this electron is basically, we say it's fundamental, it's like a point-like particle. Now, if I ask you, what do you think of a dipole? Have you ever heard the word dipole?
Mm-hmm.
Have you?
Yes.
Okay, so a dipole, you think, is like if you have both a plus and a minus charge, right? And they are very close to each other. Mm-hmm. And so usually you don't think of an elementary particle as having that structure, because you think an elementary particle is being as a point-wise thing. Now, because of quantum fluctuations, elementary particles could have a dipole that you could measure. Mm-hmm. Okay. The standard model of physics predicts a value for the electron. This value is very, very tiny. It's a zero followed by 32 or 33 zeros. Anyway, but there are models that are what we call physics beyond the standard model. We know, because of the presence of dark matter, that even dark energy, that we need physics beyond the standard model of fundamental physics. And so at the time there was a lot of excitement because they are doing measurements to see if the electron indeed does have a dipole moment or not. And so at the time I jumped into trying to see what predictions physics beyond the standard model, particularly supersymmetry, which is one of these very appealing candidates that we have, even though so far we have no evidence, what will it predict for the electron dipole moment. So I think I have changed a bit, and I jump into cosmology for the same reason, because there are going to be measurements, and maybe we can try to get some information about the physics beyond the standard model.
Sonia Pavan is an associate professor of physics at the University of Texas at Austin and has been interviewed by India Cardamone and Cole Peterson from Aspen High School. Tune in to Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30. And for more information about our Gopher program and events at the center, please visit the Aspen Center for Physics website at aspenphys.org or give us a call.